Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design, love your home.
Joining the Park City Chamber Bureau is an inexpensive and smart investment for your business. Chamber Bureau members receive private access to advertising opportunities, referrals, educational and professional seminars, business-to-business events, and other exclusive resources to help businesses grow. The Park City Chamber Bureau supports over 1,000 area businesses, both large and small. More info at visitparkcity.com or 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Welcome to this Memorial Day edition of Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley Miller, General Manager of KPCW and co-host of this show. Since today is a holiday and most businesses are closed and most people are taking the day off, we thought we'd bring you two interviews from recent shows that we found especially interesting. The first is our interview from April 30th with Premier Utah economist Natalie Gochner. She talks about Utah's Economic Summit April 27th and the message from state leaders and businesses about our economy's growth and the challenges it brings. Then our second interview is about shrinking your family budget and living the simple life. Author Elizabeth Willard Timms wrote Meet the Frugalwoods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. We'll hear her interview from March 12th in the second part of this show. Stay tuned. Mountain Money Memorial Day Edition will be right back.
Brooks Arbertson, commercial lender for Mountain West Bank, sponsor of the amazing programming on KPCW. At Mountain West Bank, we offer consumer loan options as well as home loans and business loans in one location. Mountain West Bank, just off Kearns, next to the theaters. MountainWestBank.com, division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
So there's probably a smart speaker in your home. I don't want to say her name because I don't want to turn her on without your permission. I am married, after all. Did you know you could ask her to play KPCW? You can listen to great music, news, and information no matter where you are. As long as you have that smart speaker or KPCW app on your phone or your laptop where you can stream us online, KPCW Radio isn't limited by our broadcast signal in Summit and Wasatch County. You can take us wherever you are in the world and listen like a local.
Hi, this is Kevin Holliday, bike buyer for Jan, supporting KPCW. Jan's Bike Shop is open year-round for sales and service. We offer bikes from Trek, Scott, and Santa Cruz. Bike apparel from Gore, Bontrager, and Club Rod. Available at our flagship store on Park Avenue, 649-4949 or jans.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley Miller. Natalie Gochner is the Associate Dean in the David Eccles School of Business and Director of the Kim Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah. She also serves as the Chief Economist for the Salt Lake Chamber. Gochner was a keynote speaker at the May 15th Wasatch Back Economic Summit, but before that, on April 30th, my co-host Doug Wells and I asked her about the statewide economic forum she attended just a few days earlier. In that summit, state leaders said Utah's economy is still growing, but that growth may finally be slowing down. Gochner explains.
Well, it's an extraordinary time for the Utah economy, in large part because of the length of the expansion that we're in. The state is well on its way to its second longest expansion in modern history. We're in our eighth year of a growing economy. It's a prosperous time. The federal tax cuts have pretty much ensured that that will continue in 2018. So we celebrated those, that good news, but there's certainly a lot of things on the horizon, and most importantly, I'd point to rising costs and a labor shortage as the two things that will moderate our growth.
And we are looking at the Feds possibly this week raising interest rates again. What do you think will happen, and how would that affect our economy?
Yeah, when I say rising costs, that's one of them I mean. And so you have, housing prices increasing, mortgage rates going up, you have wages rising, and as interest rates rise, it will definitely, pinch down on the economy. It will intentionally tried to quell some of the inflationary effects that can happen during prosperous times. And so that's one of a few reasons why I think the forecast for 2019 is a more moderate forecast.
So, Natalie, a lot of the growth that we've seen over the last 8 years, we have forward-thinking people in the state from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, to thank for the growth that we're seeing today. What do you think are the initiatives that we're doing today that set us up for growth 5 years from now, 7 years from now?
Doug, I love your point because I preach that. In other words, I think a lot of the good outcomes that we're having right now have come because, you know, someone decided to double the number of engineers and scientists graduating from our universities, and that decision was made in 2001, and it takes a while for that to happen, and now we, you know, reap the benefits. I would think that the Olympics were the same thing, that we benefit from the Olympics more in the out years than in the first couple of years after the Games. So right now, I think the two big ones that loom large, and they were in my presentation on Friday, but the inland port and the significant amount of effort that's going into the Point of the Mountain and the prison relocation. And I'm happy to talk about those in more detail, but those are the two big ones.
Yes, let's hit the inland port, Natalie. Can you explain to our listeners what that is and how that will affect job growth here?
Yeah, sure. Well, so if you think about Utah, we're in the center of the interior western United States, and that puts us, you know, roughly halfway between the Continental Divide and the Pacific Ocean and between the Canadian border and the Mexican border. And so we're right there in the crossroads. And because of that location, and then because of a lot of things that have happened, whether it be the new expansion of our incredible Salt Lake City International Airport or the fact that I-15 and I-80 and I-70 and I-84 all come into our state, and also the incredible Union Pacific Rail Network. If you look at a map of, you know, rail connectivity in the western United States, Salt Lake City is at the center of it. There is no city in the interior western United States with better rail connectivity than Utah. So the idea of an inland port basically recognizes that the Pacific Coast ports are crowded and expensive, and that there is some reason why you can bring those container ships to the, you know, the ports, but do all of the customs processing and unloading and, you know, redistributing from Salt Lake City rather than the, you know, SeaTac or Long Beach or wherever you want to, you know, think of in the West Coast. So the inland port, you know, just brings those containers to Salt Lake City, someplace west of the airport, where you can reprocess and redistribute and connect to that global supply chain.
So, Natalie, outside of the land where the inland port is going to be based, there's still a fair amount of controversy over whether or not it makes sense for Utah to invest in an inland port. What's the other side of the argument? What are the people that are against it saying? Why do they not see this economic opportunity?
Right. Well, I think most of the controversy has been more about who gets to decide, you know, who controls the land use, who makes those decisions. And there's been a significant amount of tension between the state legislature and Salt Lake City on this point. And I think it's unfortunate because I do think that they share common goals. An inland port is a very large endeavor, larger than Salt Lake City. It involves the entire state, multiple counties, the whole metropolitan area. So there is a significant state interest. But I think most of the controversy has been over the way that the legislature, and I'm going to use a strong word, but swooped in and took some land use powers away from Salt Lake City. And, of course, this is still in play, Doug, because, you know, the governor signed a bill saying that there were flaws in the bill and that he would convene a special session to fix them. You know, I remember the Salt Lake Tribune then editorialized that the minute the governor signed the bill, he owns this issue, and so he needs to help get the proper settlement. And so this is still playing out live fire for us, but it doesn't, in my mind, take away from the notion that investing in the global supply chain in Salt Lake City is a smart economic move for Utah.
And another speaker at Friday's summit, a gentleman by the name of Richard Barkham, he's a London-based chief economist. He was singing the praises of this airport and the new airport out there and the reconstruction that's going on. Why is that so important to Utah's economy other than bringing more tourists in?
Yeah, well, I characterize it as the gift that keeps giving, because it has all the benefits of the construction of a new facility, and those construction benefits, circulate throughout the economy. It's the largest public works project in our state's history. Now, importantly, Renee, it's being paid for without increasing our tax dollars. So they're paying for this with savings, with FAA grants, with gate fees from the airlines, and royalties from the rental car companies. And so we get this huge construction project without having to pay for it. That's a massive economic benefit to our state. More importantly, long term, we have this wonderful facility that will not only serve our transportation needs, you know, and do it in a high-quality way for tourists and business travelers, but also I think it ensures that Delta, for the foreseeable future, will have Salt Lake City as its western hub. And so that combination of things makes it a real jewel for our state.
Yeah, and keeping this as a hub for Delta is important. One of the things I've noticed as a business traveler is there are fewer direct flights to where I want to go today than there were 6 or 7 years ago. And that makes it much more difficult for me to do my job. And particularly Southwest Airlines has many fewer flights. They went into Denver, and most of their direct flights out west now, or many of them, have been transferred over. So that's been, frankly, a burden for all business travelers that are based here or trying to get here. What about the prison? I used to live down in Draper, and that was obviously very controversial. It took over a decade to make this happen, but it's taking place. What's the vision for that space, and how do we use that land to maximize economic growth here in Utah?
Right. Well, the way I presented at the summit is I made the point that there's really nowhere in this country where two large and growing metropolitan areas are merging, and at the center of that merger are 20,000 acres of buildable land, and right in the center of those 20,000 acres is 700 acres of state-owned land, that's the prison site, once the prison is moved, that can serve as a catalyst for that economic vision. So the state, I think I join other community leaders in saying that this is our opportunity to do something for people, 20, 50, 60 years from now, because if we do it right, we'll put something there that catalyzes a lot of new economic activity. And what everybody's looking at is the universities and how the universities, whether it's Utah Valley University, Salt Lake Community College, BYU, the University of Utah, can come together and have a vision for providing a workforce and research that can fuel the tech sector that is located there. So it's an extraordinary opportunity for our state. We have not made the decision of what we're doing, but they're actively studying it and I think doing a nice job.
Well, let's talk about something that could happen, maybe likely happen, about 12 years from now, a 2030 Winter Games year. You were the governor's media spokesperson for the 2002 Olympics. You saw firsthand how the Olympics helped Utah's economy. How can Utah make it even better the next go around?
Well, I think the thing that is so wonderful about our state and about our Olympic legacy is that it's living, that it continues to this day, and that so much was put into taking the surplus or profits from the games and investing them in Utah as a winter sports capital. And I get highly motivated by that. I was really happy to see this legislative session that the Utah legislature put ongoing funding on the table to help invest in these facilities. So I don't know the numbers exactly, but they gave a one-time appropriation to the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation and then have an ongoing appropriation to help with these. And it doesn't go directly to the foundation. It goes to an entity that can grant this money, but the people that will receive those grants will be these Olympic facilities. So we have just, it is another, Renee, example of a state that sees around corners, looks to the future, invests, and we're taking this prosperity and trying to do things that can help us down the road.
And the Olympics could mean a big infusion of federal tax money. How do you see that helping our transportation infrastructure? That's a big deal up here in Park City when we talk about traffic and the cars coming in for the resorts. Do you think a 2030 Olympics could provide some relief?
You know, I think it's a little early for me to opine on that just because, I think until you have leadership in place and you really know that you are the U.S. bid city and then ultimately the IOC selection, I think that a lot has to come in place before that's assured. But let's be clear, for the 2002 Games, there was extraordinary investment made in our state, and it wasn't for the Olympics. You know, we didn't like build light rail for the Olympics or redo I-15 in Salt Lake County for the Olympics. But we got our act together as a community. We knew the spotlight was going to be really bright. We went back and asked for these funds. After 9/11 and some of these security issues hit, we asked for more funds, and it ended up being quite a substantial investment in our state. I don't think it was so much the federal money as it was the fact that we came together on a unified vision for our state and acted on it.
Great. Let's go back to the summit that was recently held. Herbert not only gave the keynote address there, but on Friday, he also signed a number of bills into law. SB 131 developed a new office within the Governor's Office of Economic Development, Talent Ready, kind of focus there. SB 103 kind of strengthens the partnership between the legislature and technical colleges. I've got two more to go through. SB 104 incentivize students to pursue technical degrees. It forgives some of their educational loans. And HB 437 sets up scholarships to encourage kids to pursue certain educational degrees. Which of those are you most excited about? Which one or two would you say, you know what, this is going to make a difference for us?
Well, I attended that bill signing just because it was right at the summit, and I went in the room and watched as several legislators and the governor stood there. The top person for Silicon Slopes was there for it. I think the part that stands out for me is the connection between our economy and the technical degrees and the way that we're making that a priority. You know, if you look at job growth in our state, the fastest growing industry right now is construction. And, that requires a lot of trades to make that happen. This is partly because of the airport, but it's also because we do have a housing shortage in our state. We need to build more homes. We are creating more households than we are housing units, and that's a problem. And so we have to get after that. Even the manufacturing sector in our state is growing at 3.2%. The manufacturing sector requires people with, technical training. And so I'm very enthusiastic about the vision there. Senator Ann Milner, who was president of Weber State University, was the, main sponsor for several of these bills. And she's someone who understands the connection between higher ed and the economy.
And one of the other things Herbert mentioned in his keynote was the coming trade potential for a trade war and the damage that that causes. You're an economist, obviously a traditionally trained economist. Tariffs are a bad, bad thing. I think China has been pretty strategic in how they've struck back. They seem to be going after regions that are going to hurt congressional districts that are up for grabs in an attempt to maybe sway the outcome of elections and change things. What's your thoughts? How much at risk is Utah on what you're seeing, at least currently, in the trade wars?
Doug, I think it's a great question. And I will say that Governor Herbert's speech at the summit was, I think, among his most significant policy speeches I have heard him deliver. It was very focused on globalization and the benefits of trade to our state. And he takes a very strong position, a hardliner position, if you will, on how we need open markets for Utah exports. So it was a strong statement that he made, and I really agree with his points. I don't think that there's anything that has lifted living standards in our world more than open markets. Utah punches greater than its weight in exports, and it's everything from transportation equipment to chemicals to a lot of primary metals, a lot of information technology or computers and electronics, and we need markets for this. And the notion of a trade war just serves no purpose in my mind for the United States and for Utah, and our governor made that point at the summit. That was his focus of the speech.
Natalie, you're going to be one of the keynote speakers at the upcoming Wasatch-Back Economic Summit. That's May 15th at the Zermatt Resort, where key issues facing Summit and Wasatch counties will be addressed. And I read a comment on a news article recently about Utah's rural economic success is often seen as a them or us proposition, country versus city, rancher versus environmentalist, old-timer versus newcomer, tourism versus agriculture. Man, if we see that anywhere, it's here in Summit and Wasatch counties. What hope is there for the person who's been here for generations, who has a ranch, who wonders if the next generation can continue?
Yeah, you are at ground zero for a lot of that. I can see that. So just to give you a couple of stats that are interesting, if you look at population growth in the country, the number one, the fastest growing metropolitan area in the country was St. George last year, and the fastest growing micropolitan area in the country was Heber City last year. And then three of the top 10 fastest growing counties in the nation were in Utah last year. So these growth pressures on the in rural and on the sort of urban ring are really among the most intense in the nation, and you guys are right in the center of it. I've spent a lot of time thinking about what we call Utah's silent recession, and that is that we're in these prosperous times, but we have right now 8 rural counties that are actually contracting. They're getting smaller each year, and that's a problem. And, we have to, as a state, help these communities. And so, I don't know the answer, Renee, but I do know that the endless fighting and, tossing of bombs at each other doesn't work. And I think the best thing you can do is have a collective vision and work towards it. I give super high marks to Summit County for what it's done in critical land conservation over the years. You've set such a high standard for the state, and I think that's a positive step. I also think that there's a bunch of, realism that needs to enter the equation, and that there is an economy that has passed in many parts of our state, and it has to change and diversify. And so I think you need to put some good minds together to solve this. This is a problem in our state, and, of course, you feel the pressures more than in most areas.
Well, let's stay on this topic of kind of the dichotomy. There's areas that are doing really well, and then there's areas or places or people that are feeling challenges. And on that theme, as I was talking about the new bills that Governor Herbert signed, a lot of that was to encourage young people to get into these fields where there are going to be opportunities in the future. One of the things I see with my friends, I'm in my mid-50s, and I do have some friends that are towards the end of their career, and they were hoping to work another decade, but they found that maybe their skills, they haven't kept up with them as well as they should, and they're facing challenges in today's economy. What do you think we should be doing to get our mature workers the skill set that they need to continue to thrive until they decide to retire?
Well, you do have to set the expectation both for yourself personally, but in the government training programs, that we live in a world of continuous education and continuous learning. And there are, there's a list of things that we could be doing to help rural Utah's economy. And, most of those things deal with diversification and retraining and talent supply. So for example, it would be great to see computer coding camps, more prevalent in rural Utah, because there's a workforce there and coding can be done remotely, and you can, have your part-time job doing some agricultural things and also some steady income through tapping into the tech sector. There's lots of ideas to put coding training in rural Utah high schools. So that's just one of many ideas that I've seen floated around, and I think that it's clear that the governor's made this a priority. He's mentioned it in his last several state of the state addresses, and has an initiative to deal with this.
And Natalie, from IT to tourism, we're a large tourism-based economy up here in Park City. We know that tourism brings in a lot of money to our state with the Great Five national parks, with the ski industry. Do you see tourism growing exponentially as far as its importance in the state's economy, or will it always stay status quo?
I think that tourism is a big part of Utah's future. We have so much to offer there. And, you know, right now it is, I said, construction's our fastest growing industry right behind it. And almost the same is the leisure and hospitality industry. So I think that's huge. But I would point to a couple other things that might be helpful in this. You know, you do have some state policies that can change. We have a fund in the state. It's the Community Impact Board fund that helps fund, that comes from energy development that can be reinvested in energy economies. But right now we prohibit that money being used for economic development. And I think we need to change that. I think we can have an economic development infrastructure fund in our state where we could go invest in, let's say, really important tourism infrastructure investments that will maintain the quality of our tourism sector in the state. I think that the governor could be doing domestic trade missions where he takes business leaders off the Wasatch Front and goes into some of these rural counties and tries to find where are their connections between the urban economy and the rural economy. We go on foreign trade missions. I think we should be doing in-state trade missions. And there's even some ideas about a rural Utah Job Corps where you could, I'm just going to pick an example, but say to someone, we'll pay your tuition for this occupation. If when you finish, you go apply that craft in rural Utah. So those are just some of the ideas being bounced around. These are certainly things, when you're a prosperous state like we are, there are things we can do.
Again, that was Natalie Gochner, Associate Dean of the David Eccles School of Business and Director of the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah. She was also the keynote speaker at the Wasatchback Economic Summit on May 15th at the Zermatt Resort. Mountain Money will be right back with our interview with author Elizabeth Willard Timms. She wrote the book titled Meet the Frugalwoods, Achieving Financial Independence.
Hi, this is Whitney Ryan from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City, a Park City law office. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo's been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch counties since 1875. You can find us at joneswaldo.com.
Watch out, Wasatch Back. A whole new group of graduates is on the loose. KPCW congratulates the class of 2018. Park City Miners, North Summit Braves, South Summit Wildcats, and the Wasatch Wasps. We wish you good health, happiness, and much success. It doesn't mean now that you're all grown up that you can leave behind your favorite radio station. Take us with you. Streaming, podcast, KPCW app. Listen like a local wherever your success takes you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley Miller. Since it's Memorial Day and most people have the day off, we've prepared a holiday version of the show for you. This next segment is a replay of an interview with author Elizabeth Willard Timms on March 12th. Timms wrote the book Meet the Frugalwoods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. Here is her conversation with my co-host Doug Wells and Mountain Money producer Bob Hendricks. They began the conversation by asking Timms what she means by simple living.
For me, simple living really encompasses our holistic approach to our finances and to our life. So I embraced extreme frugality, which initially was cutting out everything that was not totally necessary in our budget. And then from there, after saving at a very high rate, I realized that I could simplify all the other parts of my life as well. And so I began to incorporate tenets of minimalism into my parenting, into the way that we operate our home, into the possessions that we own. For me, frugality really became a wholesale lifestyle transformation. So it was a question of what are my highest and best priorities? And am I always using my time and my money in service of those priorities and letting go of the things that ultimately don't matter to me? So things that I would spend money on in the past or that I would waste time on, letting go and moving those things out of my life.
And the impact can be quite dramatic, right? You and your husband retired in your early 30s. You live up in Vermont on 66 wooded acres. You mentioned that you're a parent. So was that a goal that you had to retire as early as possible, or how did you get to that point?
Yes. So, and we define ourselves as financially independent, not retired. So we work on projects that are meaningful to us and that we enjoy working on. So, for example, I write my blog, Frugal Woods, and then I recently wrote a book that came out. So that's work, in a sense, but it's work that I absolutely love. And so achieving financial independence was a goal for us so that we would be able to pursue the lifestyle that we want to live, which for us is living on this homestead in the woods. So before we moved out here, we lived in cities. We lived in New York City, Washington, D.C., Boston, Massachusetts, and we had very conventional 9-to-5 jobs, and we're living essentially the traditional American lifestyle. We were consuming things. We were trying to make ourselves happy and fulfilled through our spending. And what we realized is that spending money in an effort to make ourselves happy or in an effort to achieve contentment doesn't work. And so from that premise, we said, okay, what if we didn't spend money? What if we saved as much as we could and started working towards this higher purpose, this larger, more long-term goal?
You make it sound so simple for those of us who live paycheck to paycheck. How do you, did you have some help deciding what things to cut in your budget to do? How did you actually just begin? Start from the beginning and I cut this and then we went to this. Sure. And then what happened?
Sure, sure. So from the very beginning, my husband and I graduated from college, and we started with basically $0. So we were extremely fortunate to graduate without student loan debt. We went to the University of Kansas, so a state school, and came out very fortunately without debt. We didn't inherit any money, but came out without debt, started from zero, and said, okay, we're going to save as much as we can over the years. So as our salaries increased over the years, we continued to save at a pretty high rate. And when we were able to save enough to buy our first home when we were 28, and after that point, we didn't have a major financial goal. And that's when we started to spend more and get into some trouble. So I always encourage people, make sure that you have a goal for your money or it's going to slip through your fingers. So for us, defining that goal of moving to a homestead was very important. And your goal, your listeners' goals, will be different from ours. You know, you probably don't want to move to a homestead in the woods of Vermont. But there's something that I think everyone wants out of life more than just sort of slogging through it paycheck to paycheck. So think about where you really want to be and what you need to do with your finances in order to achieve that lifestyle. And so the first step in doing that, after you know what your long-term goal is to track your expenses. So what are you spending on every month? And I encourage people to use a free software program in order to do this. Don't guess. Make sure that you're looking at the actual dollars that you're spending every month. Go through it line item by line item and ask yourself, is this a meaningful expense? Is this something that I'm deriving a high return on my investment from? Is this something that's really getting me towards that longer-term goal? And if it's not, cut it out of your budget and see how much you can save in a month, in a year, in 5 years.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I like about what you just shared was, you know, evaluating, are you getting the joy and the experience that you want out of the money that you are spending? And I think that's important because sometimes I meet people that are doing what I call sacrificing unnecessarily. Did you find yourself in that situation as you'd review things? Maybe you cut some things out that in hindsight actually you really enjoyed?
Absolutely, yes. And so I actually offer a free challenge on frugalwoods.com. It's a month-long challenge to help you determine what you can cut out of your budget and how much you can save. So it's called the Uber Frugal Month Challenge. And what I discovered in doing this myself is that the first month is the hardest, and the first month the cuts are the deepest. So you're going to take everything out of your budget that you don't need and see how that feels. Then you have a really informed perspective from which you can evaluate that lifestyle. And then you can start adding things back in. So for a number of years, my husband and I did not go out to restaurants at all, ever, never. And that's something that we've actually added back in. So we now go out to a restaurant for dinner once a month. That's our special date night. We leave our kids at home, and that's a really wonderful evening for us. So that was an expense that we did decide to add back in. And so I encourage people to see how it feels to go without and then evaluate what it is that you would like to add back in with the full knowledge of how much you'll be spending and how much you'll be giving up in savings by doing so.
You mentioned your husband, so this is something that's going to have to, both of you are going to have to work very closely together. Did you sit down, say,
yes,
weekly or monthly and say, okay, let's look at this, what are we going to do? You do a little arm wrestling about,
yes,
what you're going to get rid of? How did that work?
Yes. So if you have a partner, this is definitely something you want to do together. It really encompasses our entire lifestyle, and so it impacts the whole family. And I think it's really important for you and your partner and your family to be on the same page and to be very transparent about what those goals are for the family, because how you use your money and how you use your time is going to dictate the type of life you have. And so having that understanding as a family unit of, you know, these are our long-term goals. We want to pay for our kids' college, or we want to be able to take that vacation together, or we want to move into a better school district. These are all things that you want to decide on together. And then when you're making these decisions to eliminate expenses, it becomes about what you're going to gain. So it's no longer about what you're giving up. It's really, oh, okay, I see we're getting that much closer to this goal that we've set out for ourselves. And I do encourage couples to have finance dates. Sit down together. Make sure that you both fully understand your money. Even if one person in the partnership is sort of in charge of paying the bills and things like that, make sure the other person knows what your net worth is. They know how much is coming in and going out. And, you know, sort of in, offer that insight to each other so that you're both working from a place of understanding and knowledge. It's really a time for an open conversation, not a time for criticism. And so I think having that open conversation with your partner about money is really important. And ultimately, for my husband and I, it actually brought us closer in our marriage because it put us on the same page. We really became partners in every sense, and we were truly on the same team.
So you get to choose your partner in life. Kids don't get to choose their parents. And my notes say that you have a young daughter. You mentioned that you leave your kids at home, so I'm guessing you have several children right now. What about your kids? They're probably still young, but as they get older, as they approach 10 or their teen years, what about getting them into the loop? And they're kind of dragged along on this lifestyle, willingly or unwillingly, and how do you think about that?
So true, so true. So our children are very young. They're 2 years old and 3 weeks old, so they don't really have a lot of opinions at this point. But what's important for us is modeling the values and the lifestyle that we think is important for our children. So from this very early age, we model for our daughters that we do live frugally. We do live a simple life. We value the outdoors. We value time together as a family. We value volunteering in our community, going to church together. So I think through any lifestyle that you lead, the best you can do is live by example and demonstrate for your children why you're doing this. It's also true for us that our kids will live this way from the outset. So they will have this understanding of simple living ingrained from the beginning. We are also big believers in spending on our priorities. And so if in the future, for example, one of our children really wants to take, let's say, piano lessons, that's something that we would pay for. If that's truly something that they want to do, that would be an example of spending on our values and spending on our priorities. So again, having that enshrined as to what you do value and knowing where you're willing to spend money. So if our kids ask for brand new toys all the time, that's not going to happen. But something that would be enriching for them would be something that we'd be happy to spend money on. And I'm a big proponent with kids of save money on the easy stuff. You know, don't buy new clothes, don't buy new toys, don't buy new nursery furniture. Get used things from thrift stores, get hand-me-downs from friends. And then you'll have the money saved up to pay for those piano lessons and those hockey lessons later on that your kids really want to do and that are going to bring a lot of value to their lives.
As you go through this process and you look next door, you look at the Joneses and see what they have, Was it difficult sometimes to say, no, we're going to stick to this plan? They've got a new car, they've got a new couch, they got. Was it difficult to stick to the plan at times?
It wasn't, because we were working towards this larger goal. So that's why I really encourage people to outline where you're headed in life. Know what that destination is, because a new couch or a new car is pretty meaningless when you think about the trajectory of your life and what you want to do with your time here on Earth. Not to put it too grandly, but truly thinking in that broader context makes a new couch seem much less enticing, or at least it did for me. And another piece of frugality for me is recognizing a gratitude mindset. So I consider myself extremely privileged and extremely fortunate to be able to save money. For many people, they don't have room in their budgets to save money, and so I'm extremely cognizant of how fortunate it is to be able to decide to be frugal. And so having that gratitude mindset and that mindset of abundance really allows me to not worry about the material possessions that I might see around me.
You know, Elizabeth, let's talk more about that, because I think as Bob was sharing, you know, some of this is a keeping up with the Joneses mentality. And you're spending money. You know, I use a phrase, you know, people are borrowing money they don't have to buy stuff they don't need to impress people that really they don't care about. It's kind of funny when you think of every piece of that cycle, there's something wrong with. And like you, I have found that being grateful is the first step to breaking that cycle. Now, you lived in some towns where this keeping up with the Joneses is pretty prevalent, right? You mentioned Washington, D.C., Boston, New York City. Those are very competitive towns, particularly when you're young and you're signaling to other people how you're doing professionally. One of the things that I found here in Park City that I really like, it is an affluent community, but it's as much about the experiences that you're doing, the mountain biking, the skiing, the getting out for the hike, going out with your dog, as it is about anything else. And so I think that helps with that environment. I've got external factors that help me to be grateful. What advice do you have for folks to help them get that grateful mentality?
Sure, and I think spending on experiences is such a great example of spending on a lifestyle that you really value and that's going to deliver that high return of happiness. So I like to say that frugality is about living the life that matters most to you, not the life that matters to someone else. Because in the end, you know, the only person who's really going to care how you lived your life is you and your partner and perhaps your children and your immediate family, but it's, you know, living for someone else and living for sort of external validations is sort of a meaningless way to live. And I say that from experience because I think I did that for many years in my 20s. And it's something that I discuss at length in the book, because it was a difficult transition for me to say, you know what, I have to start doing what I value and what matters to me, not the things that I see other people doing. And so I encourage people to really do that soul searching of, when am I happiest? When do I feel like I'm contributing my best self to society? And I think that you want to not let your spending prevent you from living the life that you want. You want to let frugality allow you to live the life that you've always dreamed of.
Well, and I think that's the quandary that I think a lot of, or the connection that a lot of people don't make. And it sounds like your 3-week-old is chiming in, so I'll say good morning to him. Good morning. No worries at all. And you know, having just had a child 3 weeks ago, thank you for being with us on air. I know that really put your life. There's a lot of pieces in the air, but you know that connection. People think, like as I mentioned, I'm a fairly frugal person, and people, you know, sometimes will ask me, you know, isn't that hard? Don't you feel like you're sacrificing? And in many ways, it's empowering. Where I want to go with this is for people that maybe it's not natural for them to be frugal, how do they take that first step so that they can feel the empowering that
paradoxically comes from maybe not buying everything on a whim.
Yes, it is so empowering. I think that's the perfect word for it. And I encourage people to do some math. So look at your expenses, like we talked about earlier. Figure out how much you could save in a month, and then calculate that out over the course of a year, 2 years, and then use a compounding interest calculator. You can find one online, and see how much that savings would generate if you were to invest it. So I do recommend investing, and people have to figure out what works for their specific financial portfolio. But see how much money you would have in 20 years, in 30 years, if you were to invest those savings, because it's going to be a very high number. And I think that's something that many of us don't realize, that starting to invest in something like a 401k, in a retirement fund, when you're very young, will yield absolutely tremendous dividends in the long run. And it might only be a couple hundred dollars a month, but that can translate into a substantial retirement amount later on. And so have that broader perspective and have that concept of delayed gratification, of what your money could do over time if you weren't to spend it today.
Let me ask you a question. This may be a silly question, but as my wife look at young families, they're having daughters, and they're thinking, oh my, in 21, 22 years from now, that's going to be very expensive. How do you tell a daughter when she turns 22 and wants to have this big, lavish wedding that she can't?
Well, I'm not sure that it's necessarily different for daughters than it is for sons. And I hope that as a society, you know, we move towards greater equality in how we raise our sons and our daughters. And I think that, again, setting that example for our children from the outset, knowing what we value as a family and building on those values together is important. I can't answer, you know, how this will play out for us in the future, or even if our daughters will want to get married. That's certainly, you know, a decision that they can make much farther down the road. But I think it's also important to be able to spend on the things that you value. So for us, we're already planning for our daughters' college educations. And I think that planning for something like that is another great way to encourage savings in the short term. So we have 529 college savings accounts for both of our girls. That's something that folks can look into if they're looking into how to save for college for the future or for higher education, because it's much more important to me that we're able to, for example, pay for that than to pay for, like I mentioned earlier, new toys or new clothes in the short term. So have that longer-term perspective, you know, of what's really important to your family and of what you do want to be able to provide for your children.
Now that you have, and I'll put this in quotes, arrived, things change in your budget a little bit? You mentioned that you're going out for dinner once a month. Are you being easier on your budget now, or are you just still sticking to the same old thing every day?
You know, once we started living frugally, we began to see so many benefits beyond just saving money that for us it's really a choice to have frugality as our lifestyle. So frugality is environmentally friendly. It gives you more free time. It allows you to let go of perfection. It lowers your stress. It, you know, it really frees you from worrying about money. And so for us, it's a very joyful way to live. And this concept of simple living is really important to us, and it's really what brings us happiness day to day. So it's not a slog for us to save money. It's truly this conscious choice. And interestingly enough, we have found that it's actually more expensive for us to live rurally here on our homestead than it was to live in the city. And I recently published an article on Frugal Woods detailing the expenses of a year living in the city and a year living in the country. And it does cost us more to live here, but it's very much spending in alignment with our values and with the life we want to live. So I think as long as you're spending in ways that, again, bring you that high level of happiness, you know, then you are spending in a way that's consistent with your long-term priorities.
Yeah, I think the secret there is being deliberate and thoughtful in your decisions on how you're spending money. I want to share, and this has got to be our last question, we've got to wrap up on this, but I want to share with you that one of my daughters is big into minimalism. I mean, she has 30 pieces of clothing, and she tracks that.
Oh, wow.
And so
that's
it's
Yeah, and she has these various, and she's 15 years old, and so she has these tools that help her be thoughtful about what she wants and what she doesn't want. And one of the big things in this minimalism movement is tiny housing. And by tiny houses, you know, anywhere from 200 square feet to 500 square feet, which is truly, you know, the definition of tiny. And there's actually some discussion here in Park City, because it's a very expensive place to live, for affordable housing and using tiny houses. And it's been somewhat controversial. You know, there's been, in general, I think, a fair amount of pushback for that. Running a blog, your blog is frugalwoods.com. Running a blog, I'm sure the subject of tiny houses come up often. Help us understand when a tiny house might be a match and when it might be a challenge for families.
That's a great question. So I do not live in a tiny house. I should preface that we don't live in a tiny home. I find it fascinating. I'm very interested in the movement. I think it's a wonderful way to reduce carbon footprint, to have more affordable housing. It's not something, though, that we have pursued. It is something that my husband and I have talked about doing after our kids grow up and leave the house. And so it might be something in our future, but I think if people are interested in it, there are many, many resources and documentaries out there of people who have lived this way and who have built their own homes. So I would encourage people to look that up.
That was Elizabeth Willard Timms, author of Meet the Frugal Woods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. And that wraps up our special Memorial Day show on Mountain Money. Thank you for listening. And thank you to our sponsors, Mountain West Bank, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Development with Viridian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. Without their help, we would not be able to do this show. Mountain Money will be back on KPCW next Monday, June 4th, with Doug Wells and guest co-host Roger Goldman. I'm Renee Bodley Miller. Happy Memorial Day, everyone.
Hi, this is Steve Roney Jr. from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and our Park City community. Our agents are located in Summit and Wasatch counties, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com or 649-7171.